die, Father, is nothing less. Ever since I was a child, I had the feeling that something is missing me. I want to know why I'm here. Can any of us know that?
Become yourself. Then God and the devil don't matter.
I want to learn. I want to understand. Be careful. Can you find the force to enable these two quite opposite lives to live together in yourself? At any moment, the wolf can devour the lamb.
And you must learn what it means to become responsible.
This is an exact threat. And that is why you are here.
It's Red Ice Radio, headquartered out of Sweden, north of the European continent. A warm welcome. Thank you for tuning in today. It's good to have you all with us, wherever you're listening from. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and if you're joining us for the first time, this is the channel where we bring you what we consider to be some of the most important, fascinating, and sometimes controversial topics. Please keep your browser tuned to redicecreations.com to follow us on a regular basis. You can stream or download our programs. First hour, always free, no commercial interruptions. And we have over a year of archived shows for you, available right there on the site. And when you want to hear more, we have the second hour of our programs available on our members' website, redicemembers.com. And everything back to 2006 is archived right there. Please have a look around. I'm certain you'll find a lot of gems in there. Today we're talking with Kevin Barrett. He is an Arabist, Islamologist scholar and one of America's best-known critics of the War on Terror. From 1991 through 2006, Dr. Barrett taught at colleges and universities, but was ultimately fired and blacklisted from teaching in American schools. The Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, names Barrett as one of the leading promoters of anti-Semitic 9/11 conspiracy theories. Kevin ran for Congress in Wisconsin in 2006 and currently works as a nonprofit organizer, public speaker, author, and talk radio host. In the first hour, we will discuss his awakening to the false flag attack on 9/11. He'll talk about the bigger agenda at hand requiring the eradication of the Constitution. Kevin explains how America is being led by a presidential dictatorship linked to a Freemasonic plot bringing us into the New World Order. All right, welcome, Kevin Barrett. Thanks for coming on our program. I hope you're having a good day so far.
It's going fine.
All right, well, good to talk to you. I've you. Known about your work for some time, so it's good to have you on the program. Why don't we just kind of introduce you, I guess, a little bit to our audience, and maybe you can just tell us about Truth Jihad, the website and the show, and kind of like the work you've been doing over the last few years now.
Sure, yeah. I'm kind of a renegade academic. I've been studying literature and various spin-offs from literature well over 20 years now. I have three MAs and a PhD, all in various literary areas. PhD is in Arabic with a focus on North Africa and Islamic studies. And I was just finishing that PhD up in 2004 when I learned of the research of David Ray Griffin. Actually, I heard of it just at the end of 2003. And Griffin had been putting together his first book on 9/11, which is entitled The New Pearl Harbor. And when I heard that such an eminent researcher as David Ray Griffin was saying that there was serious evidence that 9/11 was an inside job, that the World Trade Center had been taken out in a controlled demolition, and that no big jetliner had hit the Pentagon, my first thought was, was he smoking something? And the second thought was, well, I better check it out. know, I'd been suspicious about 9/11 from the get-go, but I had never imagined that it could be that extreme.
Mm-hmm.
So I went in and looked at the images of the Twin Towers coming down in 10 seconds, at Building 7 coming down in 6.5 seconds, at the pictures of the Pentagon and the obvious fact that there's no big plane there, and then followed up with some research to see, well, is this what it seems to be? And I finally concluded that it obviously was, and that we had been bamboozled on an epic scale, and that the media was even worse than I already knew it was. So at that point, I had the choice of either continuing down the normal academic path and spending 7 years fighting to get a tenure-track job. And doing that, of course, would preclude doing very much about this terrible situation the country was in, or else getting into activism as much as teaching and research. So I did start doing activism, and it blossomed very nicely. I had a very big success with bringing David Ray Griffin to the University of Wisconsin in 2005. It was the first very big televised 9/11 truth event. It went out live over C-SPAN and was repeatedly rebroadcast. And then in 2006, I was involved with Scholars for 9/11 Truth, which quickly picked up the support of about 100 professors around the country. And that was when I believe the opposition, that is the people who don't want 9/11 truth to ever come out, went into overdrive, and you know, instead of ignoring us, they decided to attack us and try to scare away the other professors. And I became apparently their choice of whipping boy. And suddenly there was this gigantic media campaign aided and abetted by some Neanderthal Republican politicians here in Wisconsin to get me chased out of the university. And I fought back with everything I had, and I've been fighting for 9/11 truth and transparency in general ever since.
Mm. Yeah, there are obviously people who have spent years on trying to figure out what happened on 9/11, you know, who done it and how and everything else. And maybe we can just briefly get into that. I understand it's a long story, obviously, but is there any way you can give us kind of a nutshell, if you will, of what you think happened and how it was pulled off, pretty much?
Well, sure. It was just a kind of extreme version of your classical false flag war trigger event. I guess these are two slightly separate categories. A false flag operation is when you carry out an attack and attribute it to someone other than whoever really did it. And that's often done in the context of a war trigger event. That is, when a nation wants to go to war, it often feels the need to convince its people that it actually was the victim, that it was attacked by some outside aggressor. And so typically an apparent outside attack is orchestrated or arranged. And this has been going on for a very long time. Every war the U.S. has fought since the Mexican War of 1846 was launched by one of these public relations extravaganzas. That is either a non-existent or orchestrated enemy attack that could be blared all over the headlines. I could go over each of those wars, but sure. It's kind of a long story.
Sure.
Just very briefly, Mexican War was triggered by what was called a Mexican attack on the U.S., but what actually happened was, in order to generate those headlines, a secret operation sent a bunch of U.S. soldiers into Mexican territory where they had a little shoot-up and retreated. And then the next day, the screaming front-page headlines across the country said, Mexico attacks U.S. Same thing happened with the Spanish-American War in 1898. That's where the USS Maine was blown up in Havana Harbor, killing hundreds of sailors. And the one thing that all historians agree on today is it wasn't the Spanish that blew it up. They're a little coy about admitting that it was obviously a false flag operation designed to trigger war against Spain, which allowed the U.S. to steal all of Spain's colonies, but that's obviously what it was. In World War I, U.S. public opinion was brought on board with the war through the Lusitania sinking. Big ship was loaded with passengers and armaments and sent into the path of a fleet of U-boats with predictable results. In World War II, there was an orchestrated 8-point plan to bring Japan to strike the first blow at Pearl Harbor. And the U.S. had intercepted all of the Japanese messages and broken their codes. The high command knew exactly where the attack was coming and when, and still it chose to leave 2,000 sailors out to be slaughtered as a kind of a sacrifice to the gods of war. And that turned around public opinion, which had been running over 80% against U.S. entry into World War II, and brought the U.S. into the war in a big way. Same thing happened with Vietnam with the non-existent Gulf of Tonkin attack. Essentially, there was no attack, but they ginned up a story, and the front page headlines all over the U.S. screamed out that the North Vietnamese had attacked the U.S. And with Gulf War I, we got a slightly different version of this with the story of the evil Iraqi soldiers dashing Kuwaiti babies onto the cold hospital floor to die after they'd invaded Kuwait. Of course, that never happened. It was all a big public relations event created by Hill & Knowlton, which is a Bush family-related public relations firm. But that's what brought the U.S. into Gulf War I. So virtually every American war fought in the last century and a half, a little longer than that actually, has been launched with either a false flag operation or an orchestrated war trigger event. That is, the U.S. warmongers have chosen to create an event to deceive the public into believing that the U.S. is the victim of an evil enemy attack, when in fact, it's always been the U.S. that wants to start the war in order to steal other people's property. You know, the weaker countries never want to start a war. The only countries that ever have a motivation for starting a war are the stronger countries, and yet nobody will ever attack them. So the only way they can convince their populations to get on board with war efforts is by pretending to have been attacked. So this brings us to 9/11, and of course 9/11, if it were in fact a real attack by foreign terrorists, would be essentially the first time this had ever happened in American history. Every other war has been created by our own staged public relations event, but of course 9/11 was no exception. It was a false flag attack that involved military drills. There were 46 military drills, of which more than 30 were actually happening on 9/11. Every single aspect of 9/11, hijackings, planes into buildings, all of this was mimicked by drills that were going on 9/11. And in fact, it was carried out under cover of drills. That is, U.S. military drills went live, and those drills involved hitting the towers with some kind of automatically flown vehicles, almost certainly not big Boeing airliners, blowing up the towers in controlled demolitions, blowing up Building 7 in a controlled demolition, bombing the Pentagon in three totally separate locations. Obviously, there were three separate attacks on the Pentagon. If you really believe a plane hit the Pentagon, you must believe that three planes hit the Pentagon, because there are three completely separate damage locations in the Pentagon, and they all happen to be places where enemies of the Bush family and the neocons and the 9/11 perpetrators were located. The accountants were killed in the Pentagon who were looking for the trillions of missing dollars that Rumsfeld had announced was missing. That's probably a sum that was used to finance 9/11. Mm-hmm. The Office of Naval Intelligence in the Pentagon was targeted with another bomb. Those people were killed. The ONI has always been a thorn in the side of the Bush drug-dealing CIA crime family. And then there was a third location that was targeted in the interior of the Pentagon as well. So to make a long story short, this was a military operation in which people within the U.S. Attacked their own targets. And people imagine that this would be terribly difficult to accomplish. But if it's actually much, much easier to attack your own country than to attack a foreign country. When you try to attack a foreign country, they're all working against you. Everybody in that foreign country is trying to stop you. When you attack your own country with the connivance of the top of your own chain of command, everybody is getting out of the way and letting you do it. So false flag operations are among the easiest kinds of military operations to execute. And so if you believe that the U.S. military is capable of successfully invading, let's say, Iraq, or even Panama, for that matter, they're certainly capable of doing whatever they want to do within the U.S. when the top of the chain of command is allowing them to do that. So that's what 9/11 was. It was an inside job, and it was aided and abetted by the Israelis. I believe that the Israeli spy networks in the U.S. were a key part of executing several aspects of 9/11, including the demolitions of the Twin Towers.
Do you think it's a fairly small conglomerate then that was in the know about this? I mean, obviously, as you just clarified, the drills running alongside this is how you manage to get a lot of people who are not in the know to be part of the bigger plan at work here. But any idea, any estimate of how many people you think were actually involved and in the know in the program operation?
Well, there could be as few as only one person who knew about every aspect of the operation and had the overview. And then with each of the sub-components of the operation, such as, let's say, the attack on the Pentagon, the attack on the towers, the cleanup, blaming, you know, planting evidence to try to blame 19 alleged young Arab hijackers. You know, each of these aspects of this compartmentalized operation presumably would have had at least one person who had a pretty good idea of what was going on. But the people who organized the attack on the Pentagon, for example, may very well have not had the slightest idea that nearly 3,000 people were going to be murdered in the Twin Towers. And likewise, the people that did those demolitions may have known nothing about what was happening at the Pentagon. And the people who framed the 19 young Arabs may have known absolutely nothing about why they were arranging the trajectories of those 19 guys. So there would have had to have been at least a couple of people, or, you know, at least one in the know for each major subcomponent of the operation. But that leaves us with, you know, we could have as few as maybe five people that were really totally complicit. And virtually everyone else could be just doing their jobs. You know, the people that planted the explosives in the towers, for example, may not have known what they were planting. They may have even been painting on some kind of advanced sort of, you know, thermitic, highly energetic nanocomposite is what they call it. You can paint that stuff on. Or if they were planting a mini nuke, these miniature nuclear weapons these days can be carried around in backpacks and dialed, you know, between the size of a car bomb and the size of 100 Hiroshimas.
Yeah.
So they can be disguised as anything you want. So you could just have somebody bring something into the towers and set it in a particular location. They don't know what it is. So it's possible to accomplish this sort of thing with a really minimum number of people knowing about it. But as far as keeping secrecy, it's much easier to keep such operations secret than most people imagine. There's a bias towards thinking that we know everything. You know, so people say, oh, well, look, all these secrets were uncovered. But of course, we only know about the ones that were uncovered. Maybe there are 10,000 times as many that were not uncovered. We just
don't
know that.
Yeah.
Or maybe the ones that we don't know about are 10,000 times bigger than the ones that we do know about. Maybe the biggest ones are the ones that get most effort to cover them up. So this kind of bias has led a lot of otherwise intelligent people to imagine that it would be impossible to keep something like this secret when, in fact, there's no reason to believe that.
There's been a lot of, well, fighting and effort trying to, you know, prove just which one of these methods they actually used. Was it thermite? Was it a mini nuke? Was there something else? You know, there's tons of different theories. Any favorite, if you will, that you favor among the rest?
Well, I think there's pretty solid evidence for a thermite component in the form of the article published in a peer-reviewed scientific journal, a mainstream journal, with Niels Harrod as the lead author. There was a rather shocking and staggering amount of residue from nanothermite explosives found in several samples of World Trade Center dust. So that's, you know, if that is what it is, I mean, some people believe that that's a red herring. I don't think so, personally. But there's also some evidence that there may have been something a lot more powerful blowing up these towers, because nanothermite, as far as we know, it's a questionable about whether it even can be a high explosive. It could certainly be used to slice the columns of the towers and cause them to come down, but that's not what we really see. When you study carefully what happened with the towers, there's some extremely high energy, high explosive element to what happened to them. You can see these gigantic 100-ton pieces of core column and steel frame structure being blasted upwards and outwards hundreds of feet through the air to impale themselves in neighboring buildings. That requires something with a lot more energy than nanothermite could probably supply. So there may have been a kind of overkill. My guess at this point would be both nanothermite and miniature nuclear weapons. And of course, both of these would be military secrets. And that's very convenient for the perpetrators, because when we try to take this to court, the minute we present any evidence for the use of either these top secret advanced nano energetic compounds or miniature nuclear weapons, the government can step in and say, I'm sorry, we can't be talked about in court. This is a state secret. And that's how they've shut down a couple of 9/11 court cases already. So by using classified technologies on 9/11, they were able to preclude any kind of judicial oversight of or investigation of what happened.
Interesting. So let's talk a little bit about what the fruits, if you will, of this latest false flag attack actually is. We're now 10 years into the Iraq war, pretty much. Things in America have changed drastically and around the world. We all feel it when we go out and travel to another country, etc. What do you think is the bigger agenda, the bigger plan in all of this, Kevin?
Well, it's obvious that the perpetrators of 9/11 wanted to do a number of things. They wanted to overthrow the traditional interpretation of the American Constitution and create a kind of a permanent state of emergency with a so-called unitary executive acting as a dictator. These people are disciples of Leo Strauss, the founder of neoconservatism, and Carl Schmitt, who actually was Strauss's mentor and the top Nazi philosopher. And so philosophically, these people do not have any use for a democratic republic. And they support rule by a small elite through lies and myths. And they wanted, well, they've been wanting since, you know, Strauss came to the U.S. in the 1940s and 50s and set up shop at the University of Chicago to transform the U.S. into a kind of a presidential dictatorship. And actually, Strauss and his students throughout the 1960s were his best students. He would select his brightest students, and they would be consumed with drawing up plans for a coup d'etat in the United States designed to turn the U.S. into a presidential dictatorship. So that 9/11 was obviously in the works from these neoconservatives since the 1960s. That was one of their biggest objectives. Another objective was to make the Middle East safe for Israel. And to do that required smashing the enemies of Israel with U.S. military might. And that's what's been going on since 9/11. The Iraq War had nothing to do with U.S. national interests, as this great scholar James Petras has shown with his excellent research on this. It was all about smashing a big opponent of Israel. And the long-term plan was to surround Iran with U.S. military bases in Iraq and Afghanistan, and then take out Iran, which is the Israelis' biggest threat. But there's been a backlash among patriotic American military people since 9/11, many of whom understand what happened on 9/11 and are trying to do something about it. And those people have put their foot down and prevented the U.S. from being once again hijacked by the Israelis into going after Iran on the behalf of Israel. So these are the first two things: destroying the U.S. Constitution, turning the U.S. into a dictatorship, and smashing the Middle East on behalf of Israel. And then I think there may be a sort of a third long-term plan to institute what they call a new world order. It's a term that was first used, at least in, you know, first reported in the mass media in 1991, actually on September 11th, 1991, right, by George H.W. Bush with regard to what would come after the first Gulf War. So this new world order, I believe, is linked to a kind of a Freemasonic plot. And I know many people are going to say, oh boy, this guy sure sounds like a crazy conspiracy theorist.
Well, never mind that. Just lay it all out there.
I've been called everything.
So yeah, whatever. It's fine.
And this is speculative because there is, you know, by their very nature, secret societies tend to be very secret. They don't tell you what they're up to.
That's right.
But there has been a very major role played by secret societies throughout history. For instance, the Jesuits played a huge role in the Counter-Reformation, and they became a kind of a secret police force of the Catholic Church. And they were countered by the Freemasons. The Freemasons were anti-Catholics who had to be secretive because they were persecuted by the Church if they weren't. So they formed a society to sort of undermine the Church and to usher in the Enlightenment was their original purpose. And among the Freemasons were a lot of very radical anti-religious people. And, you know, if you look at the French Revolution, what happened there during its first few years, there was this plan to completely abolish religion and institute a radical form of secularism. And I think that there are Freemasonry has always tended towards that vision, at least at its highest levels. When they, you know, when people are inducted into Freemasonry, they say, okay, you can be any religion you want. We all love religion. But I think at the higher levels, it's more consciously a secret society aimed at establishing the first world order that wouldn't be based on religion. Every society in human history has always been based on religion, and they want to create one that isn't.
Well, so let me ask you this then, Kevin, because it's a very, really interesting point, and I've found, there are many contradictions, of course. So one of the big ones for me, and the first thing we need to clarify, is that there's a difference between American Freemasonry and European Freemasonry or in other parts of the world. Because one thing that I've noticed is that obviously on the highest level of the many of the orders in Europe, at least, you do have the royals as protectors of the orders. They're actually, you know, in there with the with the United Grand Lodge of England, and you know, the royal family in England is obviously closely connected to the Anglican Church and everything else, and the royals seem to be kind of an interface between Freemasonry and the religious orders as well. So the question is, okay, is that only for show? Is that just, you know, because it looks good externally or whatever? But I mean, I've also heard this about Freemasonry, that they're kind of, you know, revolutionary in its origin, that they're for, you know, kind of a libertarian kind of ideology, at least what it used to be known as the word, you know. But today it's very different. So the question is either something has changed or it's just a ruse. It's just a plot. I mean, do you find that to be contradictory of how the royals are in charge of this right now?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I think that the way you can kind of put this together is that, you know, any secret society over time is likely, especially if it's dedicated to advancing the material position of its adherents, it's likely to turn into an organized crime ring. Because when you have, you know, people working together to advance each other's careers and keeping it secret, and they're sworn to protect each other and to uphold their brotherly bond within their order above and beyond the laws of their country, where they can, you know, walk into court and make the secret sign, and the judge will let them off and so on. Yeah. Obviously, this is by definition a criminal organization. And given that they're trying to advance each other's careers and make money, they're naturally going to move into those areas of the economy that are illegal and that are highly lucrative. You know, a good example is Skull and Bones, which is a satanic Freemasonic society based at Yale University. And they've been dealing in drugs and slaves back in the days of slavery and other illicit areas, prostitution, so-called white slavery, and all, you know, all the things that organized crime deals in. They've been doing that forever, and they induct people into their order by having they pick the smartest or the highest IQ sort of borderline psychopaths they can find among the student body at Yale University. They bring them down into the so-called tombs beneath their big concrete building, and they have the inductee lie down naked in a coffin and masturbate while recounting his entire sexual history in front of the other bonesmen, they call them, as well as their parents. And this kind of, you know, totally turns them into shameless people, and it also gives them a bond with the other sick, perverted people who have done this. It's kind of the same psychology that gangs use when gangs induct someone by forcing them to earn their stripes by killing someone. And then everybody in the gang knows that you've killed someone, and so your bond with them is very tight because you'll never betray them or they have something on you. Well, same thing with Skull and Bones. And I think that at least, you know, not all Freemasons, of course, are directly involved in this kind of extreme psychopathic criminality, but some of them are. And that's, I think, what the whole thing has turned into is, you know, originally it had these high ideals of trying to pursue the goals of the Enlightenment. You know, they really believed that religion was repressive and they were going to liberate humanity from its shackles and so on. And some of them were kind of crazy extremists, sort of Marquis de Sade kinds of people. And those people naturally are going to be good at making money through organized crime. And so it ends up being kind of a criminal mob.
You're saying, Kevin, even if the intention was good, a secretive order of such will soon enough get infiltrated with people that want to use the infrastructure, basically, that's there in place to keep the secrets, if you will, and they're using it for their own purposes of criminal activity.
Well, absolutely. And today, I think that some of these secret societies, which may work with others, cultivate folks to plant them in intelligence agencies and other high-level positions. Skull and Bones is well known to feed people into the CIA. And guess what? The people they feed into the CIA tend to work with the Bush crime family, which is one of the biggest drug dealers on the planet. So you have this Masonic satanic organization recruiting people to get into the American CIA and to be a part of its criminal wing, the same criminal wing that was involved in various assassinations, including those of the Kennedys, that's involved in drug trafficking, and presumably was involved in 9/11. And so these secret societies can plant people in different intelligence agencies and police agencies, and therefore you can have people in the FBI who are covering up 9/11 on behalf of their secret society. You can have people in the CIA who are carrying it out on behalf of their secret society. People in the Israeli Mossad who are running folks making 9/11 happen on behalf of their secret society. And I do think that there's some evidence supporting the contention of one group of researchers that big banking interests have financed some of the more criminal wings of Masonry. And you know, the Rothschilds are always talked about in this regard, that the Rothschilds have apparently established a kind of a place at the top of the pecking order in world banking. And given their enormous fortunes, which I've heard estimated as high as the over 100 trillion, which sounds ridiculous given the U.S. GNP per year is 15 trillion or less. But that means the Rothschild family has more than seven times the annual GDP of the U.S.
Yeah,
that's pretty ridiculous. And you can understand how people with that kind of money available would be able to buy off the highest IQ psychopaths on the planet,
sure,
and send them to the tops of all of the intelligence agencies and all the other power hierarchies, and then orchestrate things like 9/11 from behind the scenes.
Well, and this is where it gets really interesting to me then, because obviously you have a lower end crowd here that potentially just are interested in the money and or the criminal activity itself. But the question is, the higher up the ladder, you know, we go, Kevin, and everyone is trying to ask this question, of course, but what the true intention and purpose is, if it's simply control, the subjugation of the rest of the planet, put it under their, domination, pretty much, their control. And potentially the Rothschilds is at the top of this. Some people have speculated that the Rothschilds is just basically handling the money for another family or another group. So, I mean, who knows? What do you think?
Yeah, this effort to try to name who's at the top is one of the little parlor games that people play in the conspiracy community. And I'm not sure it's all that useful. You know, like, you have big fights between like Alex Jones, who really doesn't want to name the Rothschilds or say anything about anybody who happens to be Jewish. And then you have others who really are convinced that this whole thing is like very much ethnically Jewish at the top. I'm not sure that those kinds of discussions are useful. You know, some people say it's the Jesuits and other people would say it's the Royals. And, you know, then you have David Icke and his friends who think there are reptilian aliens lurking in there somewhere. I don't know if the issue is really like who's at the top of the pyramid per se, but just sort of, you know, how it works. And what they're trying to do. And I think it's obvious that what they're trying to do is to establish the first very strong global government, a government that controls the entire world. And that's another meaning of the term the New World Order. The New World Order is new in that it's the first world order, or the first order that's not based on religion. And it's also new in the sense that it's the first time that the entire world has been under one order, that is, under one strong government. And of course, the New World Order, I think, also means that the New World, that is, the Americas, have a big role to play. The founding fathers of the U.S. were all Freemasons, virtually all, at least. Washington, D.C. is one big maze of Freemasonic symbols. And 9/11 was obviously a Freemasonic coup d'etat. The biggest symbol of Freemasonry is the two towers, the towers of Hiram the Builder.
Jackin and Boaz, yep.
Right, there you go. and apparently pentagons and pentacles are also very big, especially in satanic Freemasonry. So doing something at the Pentagon is a kind of a natural thing for them to do as well. So yeah, I think it's about creating a world government. And since they're doing it this secretively and this violently and viciously and mendaciously, it's obvious to me that these are not people we want in control of the whole world. So it's really the duty of all decent people to fight back against this.
It's quite a battle. Now, I want to ask you a little bit about the relationship between Zionism and Freemasonry as well. You mentioned Leo Strauss earlier. He was, of course, belonging to a Zionist youth group who's been pro-Israel for his life, as far as I know. And you mentioned also that the U.S. might have been used by Israel. So what is the Zionist connection in all of this, Kevin?
That's a good question. I think there's some evidence that Israel was created sort of as a private Rothschild family fiefdom and crime base. And it's a base not only for the Rothschilds themselves, but for associated financial and criminal interests. And, you know, it's clear that the State of Israel was essentially created through the Balfour Declaration, which it didn't come right out and say that they're going to ethnically cleanse Palestine and create a Jewish state, but it that was what gave them the foot in the door. And it was Lord Rothschild who negotiated the Balfour Declaration by stepping in and saying, well, World War I is bogged down. It was, you know, 1917, and the front hadn't moved for a while, and Britain was about to propose a kind of a status quo ante peace treaty with Germany. Say, we'll go back to where we were before the war and call it off. And a Rothschild stepped in there and said, well, don't do that because we can help you win the war. And after the war, you're going to get what used to be the Ottoman Empire, including Palestine. And all you have to do, if you want us to win the war for you, is to promise that you're going to give us Palestine after the war. So that was the deal that created Israel, was the Rothschilds used their immense financial power and their control of the media in the U.S. to drag the U.S. into that war, which is a war the U.S. had absolutely no interest in whatsoever, no reason to fight. And they also torpedoed Germany. The Rothschilds had tremendous power in Germany, and they used that power to defeat Germany.
Yeah,
this is one reason why Hitler was so, his friends were so angry at Jews, was they had been screwed over by actual, real, live Jewish bankers.
That's right.
Why they took that out on all of the rest of the Jewish population that was mostly innocent of this is a good question. So I think Zionism plays a pretty important role here, because as far as we can tell, the Rothschild family and the banking, the biggest banking sector in general, is right at the heart of this New World Order plan. And these are the same people who created the State of Israel. And they, you know, there are rumors that they want to institute world government based in Jerusalem. There are other, you know, there are stories about Freemasonic associations to this. The Temple of Solomon is supposed to be a key part of this new world government.
Well, they've already have some pretty interesting architectural, you know, buildings in Jerusalem, and some of their, I think it's their court, their governmental, you know, building basically as well. It's, well, highly rich in Freemasonic symbolism, if we should be nice about it.
Right, right. And of course, the culmination to this is the plan to demolish the greatest Islamic architectural monument on earth, which is the Masjid al-Haram with its dome on the rock, and to reinstitute what they would claim would be the Temple of Solomon. And this, of course, is huge in Freemasonry. Freemasonry traces itself back to Solomon, who's reputed to be a great magician. And these people are all, you know, magicians at the high levels of Freemasonry. They claim to be interacting with the spirits, or the jinn, as we call them in Islam. Mm. And so they have this plan to demolish the Masjid al-Haram in Jerusalem and to rebuild this temple and start sacrificing pink heifers. Now, it's hard to tell whether the people at the top really believe this and are planning this, or whether this is some of the, you know, wacky Christians in Kansas who've been, you know, reading their Schofield Bible too much. But there are people who've already tried to destroy the Masjid al-Haram. There have been plans to blow it up. There are these crazy people who, you know, keep massacring Palestinians there, thinking that these horrors are going to somehow bring back Jesus and bring back the Second Coming. There's a whole set of these kind of quasi-religious mythologies centered around Jerusalem. So obviously there's some kind of New World Order connection there. And I wouldn't be surprised if the plan is indeed to start World War III against the Islamic world and bring it to a fever pitch by blowing up the Masjid al-Haram and rebuilding this temple and instituting some kind of Zionist-based world government out of Jerusalem. Now, maybe that's all just mythology, but it's really strange how actual events seem to follow this plan.
Yeah.
No rational secular person would have ever thought that any of this would ever happen. If you'd gone back to the year 1900 and said this is, you know, it's going to play out like this, they would say, "Well, you must be crazy. You must actually believe in the protocols of the Elders of Zion." But you know, now we look back at it, sure, the protocols is probably a forgery, but it's uncanny how it predicted everything that's happened since then.
Well, what's interesting about that, too, is that makes all of this basically theatrics. I mean, okay, granted, there could be an idea that there is some also some prophetic stuff playing out here, that there is a supernatural element to all of this. But nonetheless, if we look at it, if the game plan has been laid out in such a way, you know, before and then now it's being followed, it also means that, you know, quote-unquote regular people are, they're drawn into this theater. They're, you know, playing a role in it, and it's like, I don't know. It just feels like globally we're all like hanging on strings, and the puppeteer is up there somewhere doing the job and just playing out the theater. You know, that makes it kind of dull and boring. Also, at the same time, sad. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it is. It's kind of tawdry in a way. I mean, 9/11, in some ways, was like theater, or even more like a movie, because the purpose of everything that was done on 9/11 was to produce the right kinds of television images and the right kind of TV discourse to brainwash people. So in that sense, 9/11 was like a movie. And it's very theatrical, the way they would have used, you know, they would have scripted it. They would have then storyboarded it. A storyboard is when, you know, people are making a movie, they draw pictures of the key scenes. And it's sort of like a cartoon sequence of the key scenes in the movie. So they'd script it, they storyboard it, and then they work out the special effects that are going to be necessary to produce the images that they want in those key scenes. With 9/11, the key images apparently were, you know, planes hitting towers and exploding into fireballs, and in, you know, towers collapsing in huge dust clouds, pyroclastic dust clouds chasing people down the streets of New York. You know, these had all been, you know, sketched out as storyboards. And in order to get those special effects, so that these images would actually be seen by the audience, which is virtually like, you know, like a reality TV audience or a movie audience, they would have gone through the various demolition modes that were available. There was this software called Blast Code, which came out, I think, in 2003. And the military version of it would have been more powerful and would have been available earlier. And they probably used Blast Code software and similar kinds of simulation software, special effects software, to see what it would look like and what would happen to the building if they tried various ways of blowing it up or bringing it down. Mm-hmm. So they could have run through hundreds or thousands of practice sessions demolishing the Twin Towers, looking at what happened to the building and what it looked like. They could have used the software to do that, and then they would have finally decided on one particular way of destroying these buildings so as to produce the most powerful images in order to shock the audience. And brainwashing is all based on shocking the target and regressing the target to a childlike state, shaking the person loose from their normal moorings in reality, so they don't know what's going on, and then moving in as a surrogate parent figure, a voice of authority, to tell that person what's going on. And when that is done to someone, that person will internalize what the voice of authority or the parent figure tells them.
Yeah.
And they will never let go of it. That's why so many people, even today, will never be able to look at these obvious demolitions of these three skyscrapers and see them for what they are. Because deep in the unconscious recesses of their minds, the voice of authority on 9/11, when they were still shocked and disoriented, told them that this was a foreign terrorist attack and these buildings just fell down.
Well, and also I wanted to just emphasize another point you made about the storyboard, because there's this interesting game developed by Steve Jackson, basically the Illuminati card game, and that's just highly interesting how many of the cards are actually, you know, prophetic in that way, and I don't know how much of that you've seen, if at all, Kevin, but it's... It's pretty interesting. I mean, they have 9/11 in there, the attack on the Pentagon, the World Trade Center, the two towers, and there's just endless amounts more. And so that's another reference to, I mean, you talked about the protocols earlier being another reference point. So it seems like, you know, either fiction is in some way, you know, drawing this in some way, it's making it happen, or it's a plan. Someone actually knows what's going on and following it accordingly. I just don't know yet, but there seems to be multiple of these kind of you know, storyboards, if you will, out there that are being followed currently.
Yes, yeah, it seems that way, and it does. You know, you wonder to what extent history is really being scripted, to what extent it's just being sort of nudged from here to there. You know, to what extent are these people sort of making it up as they go along, and to what extent are they following some kind of long-term master plan? It's really hard to tell. but it seems to be kind of working in the same direction. At this point also, you know, I think they control the Western world a lot more than the rest of the world. And maybe what's happening right now is we're seeing this sort of intensification of the this new imperialism. And it's designed to go out and transform and kind of colonize the world as much as possible using the military and financial tools of the West, which they control, before the West is eclipsed by the rest of the world, which is happening, you know, even as we speak. The BRIC economies, Brazil, China, India, and we could throw in a few others, Turkey, and you know, the other, some of these other non-aligned up-and-coming countries are growing at 10% a year, and the U.S. and Europe are really not growing much at all. And if you project that just through a pretty, you know, short number of years, very quickly the West loses its edge. You know, as of today, I think the West is still producing half of global GNP roughly, mm-hmm. and that's going to go down to close to 15% by 2050. That's a gigantic collapse in the West's proportion of global GDP. So before the West loses its edge, before China overtakes the U.S. as the biggest economy on Earth, which means that within a few years after that, it will probably become the biggest military power on Earth. You know, before that happens, and that could happen within a decade, you know, I think they want to really intensively use their military power, just unleash it to get as much done as they can in laying the groundwork for a world government that they would be able to run. And I think some of them are willing to be more reasonable in sort of negotiating a more multipolar world, while others, like the Project for a New American Century, are dedicated to sort of total global dominance from one position. So that's kind of where I think they're going with it. You know, and I think that's the difference between, for instance, Dr. Brzezinski, who's the leading realist strategist, who just wants to use Western power to try to nudge the world in a direction that's more amenable to Western values as it becomes multipolar, versus the neocons who want to use every bit of power available to basically crush the rest of the world in order to try to maintain this Western dominance. So I'm not sure that there's sort of one command center where they all agree. I think they sit down and often disagree with each other, just like the Council on Foreign Relations, which some people think is the kind of the heart of this conspiracy. But there are all sorts of different people at the CFR, including really good people like Richard Falk, who I've had on the radio several times. He's a fine man. I think they all sit down and talk at the Council on Foreign Relations, and then some kind of consensus comes out of that, which is implemented by the Central Committee of the Council on Foreign Relations. Now, there is no such thing officially, but I think there is unofficially, and I think that's how it works, is that this kind of, you know, secret central committee would listen to what everybody is saying at the CFR and then make decisions sort of based on that. So I, as far as I can tell, I don't really believe in a kind of a long-term, tightly controlled, fully scripted storyline that they're all, you know, pushing consciously. You know, I think it's more power reacts to unfolding historical circumstances, trying to maintain its own power and to increase its own power as much as it can.
And then obviously, as you point out, different groups trying to nudge, you know, history, if you will, in their way, in their favor, and you get a reaction to this in many cases. I think it very unfortunate if one believes that it's only, as you say, just one group out there that's completely dictating everything. I think there's multiple different interest groups out there and agendas going on at the same time. And what we're seeing is that these, you know, more or less are clashing with each other. But the overall question is, are we still moving ahead, you know, one step, you know, two step forward, one step back, kind of the tippy-toe tactic towards a totalitarian, you know, global government? That seems to be the case nonetheless, whatever fine, you know, nuances are, you know, as on the side effect of that, if you will, Kevin.
Yes, it does seem that way. One interesting question about that is this completely by design, or is it possible that the powers that be just think that this is inevitable due to the progress of technology? You know, if you go and look at Brzezinski's early writings, in when he discussed the architectonic society or whatever, that he said that in the future the technology would reach the point where well, you know, basically everybody's going to get chipped, and the powers that be will have these immense technological resources at their disposal, which they will use to control the people. And he isn't writing it in such a way as to say, well, this is what should be done because the world will be better if we do this. Now, there were some people like that. There was some guy who, Beyond Freedom and Dignity, I think it was. Was it B.F. Skinner? One of those Skinner type people.
Sure.
Was, you know, those guys were advocating for an Orwellian police state. But Brzezinski wasn't. I think he was just saying that this is what's bound to happen because our culture cannot turn down any technology that comes along. And people are going to grab whatever technology comes along and use it for whatever it works for, and use it to increase their power. And so this technology is going to have the effect of allowing a very small elite class of technocrats, perhaps funded by a small elite class of bankers, to control the world using this technology. And it's just going to happen. It's not because we want it to happen. It's just for the same reason that when some new technology comes along, it's always going to play itself out. You know, when has this culture ever said no to a particular technology? If it shows up, it gets used. You know, the Chinese weren't like that. Ancient Chinese culture supposedly didn't bother using gunpowder for weapons for centuries. Instead, they were using it for fireworks to chase away evil spirits. But the West is not like that, and the planet has followed the West. So now whatever technology is out there is going to be grabbed and used for power, according to this line of thinking. So it could very well be that it's not some grand master plan to enslave humanity. It's just that the currents of history and the inability of this particular culture to put any kinds of limits on technology has led to a situation where the powers that be have said, well, it's inevitable. Let's just, you know, go along with it.
Well, I mean, we have people like Michio Kaku, the theoretical physicist who's on American TV all the time talking about a new world order and how, you know, this is going to be the global culture pretty much, you know, blue jeans and Madonna and Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, that's the new cultural icons, and t-shirt and jeans are going to be the costume of the new world order. Kind of jokingly, but at the same time, you know, he's trying to argue that, you know, in a way that you did as well, that this is just kind of inevitable, that this is just going to happen. So we have that line of thinking, Kevin, and then at the same time, we have more of a sinister aspect to this when you begin to look at people like, you know, Darwin and some of his buddies with Francis Galton and Bertrand Russell, that humanity is going to split off in two and that we have to subjugate one of these lower-end classes to complete control and domination. So there's two different strands here, I think, as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think there are different strands. That's interesting about, you know, blue jeans and t-shirts being the new uniform of a new world order, McDonald's in every city, everybody listening to the same popular music and so on.
Horrible.
Yeah. and of course, that reaction is natural. And I don't think that it's quite that inevitable at a cultural level. You know, I don't know about the technology. You know, I get a little frightened by these projections about what technology will be able to do in terms of controlling people. But as far as this idea that sort of this Western culture of sort of loose sexual ethics and blue jeans and t-shirts and kind of, you know, dumbed down, pleasant, popular music, and, you know, Hollywood movies, this is going to be universalized. I don't think so, because there's always going to be a reaction against that. There's a wonderful book by George Steiner, who's one of the great linguists and philosophers of the century, called After Babel. And Steiner points out that that language has both centrifugal and centripetal tendencies. So the tendency in using language is both to be able to reach out and talk to everybody and, you know, bring people together, universal language, which of course is what they were trying to build with the Tower of Babel, according to the biblical story. And then it also has this sort of centrifugal tendency of spinning off away from the center as people want to kind of have their own language with their own small group of people. And in a natural state, when you don't have mass media or big political structures, the language groups quickly become more and more particularized on the local level. And pretty soon, you know, you walk 20 miles and people talk quite differently from how you talk where you're from. You walk 40 miles and they're very really different. You walk 100 miles and it's a new language. You can't even understand them. A good example of this continuum is on the north shore of the Mediterranean, there's a kind of a continuum between Spanish, French, and Italian. And as you walk along the shore of the Mediterranean, you know, the language shifts. But it's not doesn't shift all at once. It goes, you know, you go in these sorts of in-betweens. It's all continuous. So there is this tendency for languages to become sort of private languages of smaller groups that want to set themselves off from the larger group and the official group. We see this with slang and argot. We see, you know, African Americans, for example, have created their own version of American English to define themselves as different from the mainstream white culture. And this kind of thing happens at all levels, all the time. So I think that culturally the same thing happens. If there's a proposed universal culture where everybody is being told by these big New World Order controlled media outlets that they're supposed to eat McDonald's hamburgers, wear blue jeans and T-shirts, dance to the same music, have the same ethics, believe the same things, have the same kinds of governments, there's going to be a reaction against that. Everybody is going to run off in their own direction against it. We're already seeing that, I think, with the sort of rebirth of ethnicity and different groups splitting off, wanting to have their own countries. Part of that's being helped along, ironically, by the New World Order itself, which is smashing up the Middle East into smaller pieces on behalf of Israel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We've had, you know, Libya smashed into the Salafi East and the pro-Gaddafi West. We've had Iraq smashed into three pieces, the Shia South, Sunni Center, and the Kurdish North. And right now they're trying to do the same thing to Syria. They've smashed Sudan into the so-called African Christian Israeli-occupied South and the so-called Arab North.
I wonder, Kevin, sorry to interrupt, but it's a good point, and I'm wondering as well if this is part of the idea that they're trying to create kind of like the global village, that they're trying to create kind of it's important to break up nations so you can create this kind of tribalism almost, but it's going to be ruled under a global, you know, dominative world government pretty much, and you have these small, tiny regions that on their own really can't do anything except, you know, living the way they want, perhaps, and that could be a part of it as well, that this is kind of like what, was it Huxley who talked about, basically people who are going to be, they're going to like their servitude, basically, they're going to be enjoying the dictator that rules over them, and they might not even know about it. So the question is, if they've kind of counteracted and realized that, okay, we got to try a different strategy here, let's try to break it up and you know, give them, you know, this kind of fox individuality and self of that they can rule themselves pretty much, but it's not more different than, you know, putting a different color on your Android phone or whatever. It's like do you see what I'm getting at? It's kind of,
yes.
Yeah, anyway.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's right. Dr. Brzezinski has actually talked about this. He's said that, you know, people have this inner dignity and they have the right to sort of be themselves culturally, and therefore these nation states should break up into smaller units where they can express actual ethnic cultures. And of course, the side benefit to the New World Order is that smaller units are, as you say, much, much easier to control. There are some thinking that the 9/11 attacks may have been not only efforts to use the U.S. military to achieve these New World Order objectives in the Middle East, but also efforts to essentially destroy America as a cohesive entity.
Yeah.
There have been efforts to break up the U.S. on the part of these European banksters forever.
Yeah.
They supported the Southern secession in the Civil War, killed Lincoln when he printed greenbacks. They paid the Mormons, who they were hoping would create, you know, help fund Mormonism, hoping there would be a separate Mormon kingdom splitting off from the U.S. So it could be that 9/11 was partly intended to just gut the American national tradition, which does rest on the bedrock of its constitution. And today that constitution is defunct. It's dead as a dodo. It's gone. And the country is demoralized. People are really, I think, paralyzed. They've been rendered helpless by this really obvious false flag operation on 9/11 that they can't quite bring themselves to see and do anything about. Sort of like Hamlet was paralyzed in the play by Shakespeare. And of course, that play ended badly in a big bloodbath. And the Kingdom of Denmark was, so not only was there something rotten in Denmark, but Denmark is going to fall apart because of it. Mm. Likewise, there's something rotten in the USA regarding 9/11, and that's going to cause a bloody decomposition of the US. U.S. middle class was really always the biggest threat, according to this line of thinking, to the New World Order project. And if they are going to dominate the whole world from kind of a perch in the world banking system, in which the world's wealthiest bankers pay, you know, a few hundred or thousand of the brightest technocrats to rule the earth, they're going to have to remove any competing centers of power that could give them a run for their money. And the U.S., is certainly a competing center of power that if the American people were using their democratic republic to pursue their own interests, they would not let this New World Order get off the ground. You know, if the American people were actually running their so-called democracy, they would never have allowed the bankers and the industrialists to move all of the manufacturing out of the U.S. over to China and other countries with very low wages. They would never have allowed the U.S. to open up its borders and allow millions and millions of Mexicans and other Hispanics to completely change the composition of the country and burden it with tremendous difficulties. So they had to basically destroy American democracy and prevent Americans from pursuing their own actual interests in the world. And I think 9/11 may be kind of the coup de grace in that respect, that it has paralyzed and demoralized the U.S. and essentially enslaved the American people to these secret forces. And they may now have to deal with China. China is another potential threat. It could be a country of over a billion people that could try to act cohesively as a separate independent center of power. So they're going to have to try to contain China's rise as well. So I think that is what they're doing. They're trying to smash up competing centers of power. You know, in the Middle East, they smash countries that could compete with Israel, and globally they're smashing the larger countries that have educated middle classes that might want to act in their own interests rather than the interests of the New World Order.
Very good, Kevin. We're going to round things up for the first segment here in just a few minutes. It's been very interesting, and it sets the stage very well for some of the things I'd like to get into in the second segment. We've kind of briefly touched upon it in terms of the monoculture and all that, but kind of, you know, the class of civilization, even the role of Islam and all this, and how religion is used to dominate and control and start wars. And there's a lot of nuances here that I want to get into as well. But before we take a break here, Kevin, please give us your details of your website. If you do have any material out there you'd like to, reference to our audience who want to find more about you and your work. So if you have any books or DVDs or anything like that out there, please give out the details.
Sure. Yeah. My website is truthjihad.com, and I have a radio show which is at a blogger website. Just Google Truth Jihad Radio and you'll find that. I write for Veterans Today and Press TV, and I'm also trying to help organize a million American march against fear in Washington, D.C. on September 11, 2013. This used to be the Million Muslim March. We were going to bring a million Muslims to D.C., but we decided there were so many supporters who were non-Muslims who want to support this march against fear, and also, of course, for 9/11 truth, that it's opened up now for everyone. So you can Google that on Facebook or search for it on Facebook, the Million American March Against Fear. And my website is truthjihad.com.
Truthjihad.com. Okay, we'll have that linked up. Thanks, Kevin, for this first segment. We'll take a break right here, and we'll return with more shortly.
Thirsty for a beer, that I had to go to see. better than a kiss. I wish you all could see. I'm a long, long way from home, but this photograph of you, even though it's monochrome, tells me what I should do. So I got up on my feet, and I knew it would be alright, for my clothes were looking neat in the middle of the night. I don't want.